I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Just as quickly as it made headlines today, a story about how a proposed Republican ad campaign that would link President Obama to his controversial former pastor, Jeremiah Wright, has been shot down. A decision made by the deep-pocketed Republican at the center of it. Joe Ricketts, the founder of TD Ameritrade and family owner of the Chicago Cubs, says the ad campaign he had discussed with Republican strategists will not see the light of day. It was first reported by the New York Times. With us on the line is Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC News. Rick, this was an idea that Ricketts had intended to float. He wanted to get public reaction, and he got it. What has public reaction been?
It's been fierce, and it's been swift, and it's been almost entirely negative, also including Mitt Romney, who has immediately said that he'd repudiate any ad that took a personal attack on President Obama's background. What's interesting about this is that there were McCain advisors who desperately wanted to use the Reverend Wright videos and sermons. Sarah Palin was in that camp against President Obama 4 years ago, and they were turned down by the candidate himself. John McCain says he's not going to go there. Now we learn about this plan that would have used it in a very explicit and very direct and very potentially damaging way. And as you say, it's been strangled pretty early in the action.
And so because this came up back in 2008, there wasn't anything particularly new. We already knew that Obama had attended Jeremiah Wright's church in Chicago, but hadn't listened to some of his black theology sort of sermons. So was there anything new that you think was going to come out of this, or was it just repurposing it for this new election?
It was repurposing, I think, just reminding people of videos that maybe they saw pretty widely 4 years ago. And I think one of the reasons that there are so many Republicans who are hesitant to go there is that they don't think it would work. I think one key element we've seen from the Romney campaign so far is they don't actually mind if you like President Obama. They just don't want you to vote for him. So any kind of personal attack may backfire. So that's why we're seeing these signals right now. They just want this to be about the Obama economy, not about who President Obama went to church with years ago.
Rick, what can you tell us about Joe Ricketts, the guy who was behind the campaign, and the super PAC he's associated with? It's called the Ending Spending Action Fund.
Well, the name actually gives you a big clue as to his politics. He's a registered independent, a very strong fiscal conservative. It is fiscal issues that has him worried. He's not a fan at all of President Obama, and he's going to bankroll some very expensive and I'm sure very effective potentially ads against him. But they're going to be focused on spending issues because that's what animates him. He immediately put out a statement saying that this was never going to be a plan that he went with. This was the work of one particular ad man, Fred Davis, who's quite notorious for inflammatory ads, but that he intends to make this about spending issues, and he wants President Obama to be defeated, but doesn't want it to be over these kind of social or cultural divisive issues.
Now, of course, the Democrats continue to target Romney's record at Bain Capital. Those are tough ads. There are new ads out this week. Is your sense that this ad campaign that just got killed was going to be so much more inflammatory than what's going on with Bain that it took it to another level?
Oh, I think this would have taken it to the stratosphere. I mean, this is the ultimate attack you can launch at President Obama to give wide airtime to the speeches of Jeremiah Wright. This is something that President Obama has been personally uncomfortable with throughout his time running in national office. They know that these videos are out there. They know that they've gotten wide play. But to put big money behind them and have it on the screen of every person in America, again, this isn't his record we're talking about. These are people that he associated with. It's a different level of attack, and I do think it would have been extraordinarily inflammatory.
So even though the campaign isn't going to happen, has it already in some ways achieved its goal? Because there's a lot of press about it, so suddenly Jeremiah Wright is back in the news, Obama's connection to him is back in the news. Has something been accomplished from a Republican perspective anyway?
There's some Republicans, I think, who were whispering about that, saying they got to do this without putting any money behind it or being associated with it. Mitt Romney can say, I don't associate myself with this. I repudiate any ad that does it. That doesn't mean that it won't be seen and that it won't be effective and it'll get now free media. And it's possible that someone else picks up the ball and decides to fund an ad like this. There are lots of wealthy people that don't like President Obama and want him to be defeated and may not have the same moral compunction about going personal as Mr. Ricketts does.
Rick Klein is senior Washington editor for ABC News. Rick, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's getting worse at J.P. Morgan, which has now lost $3 billion. That's a billion more than the bank said it lost last week after a series of bad trades. The Federal Reserve Bank is looking into the extent of these losses and the transactions that caused them. So is the FBI. And at least one investment fund with money in J.P. Morgan has filed a class action lawsuit against the bank. J.P. Morgan, meanwhile, says profits elsewhere will cover its losses. But last week's events have tarnished the reputation of the firm's CEO, Jamie Dimon, who is widely considered the nation's most highly reputed banking executive. The New York Times has called him the Obama administration's favorite banker. But now many commentators are saying that Dimon's fall from grace may be the best chance for stronger regulation of the financial markets. Peter Coy, economics editor for Bloomberg Businessweek, is with us. Peter, the specifics of how this loss happened aren't entirely clear yet, but what do we know about those transactions and how they went wrong?
The chief investment office where the problems occurred is supposed to be a risk-reducing part of the organization, managing excess cash, making sure that the company's overall balance sheet is not taking on too much risk. But it seems to have gone over the past 5 years, as Bloomberg News first reported in April, from a risk-reducing part of the organization to one that actually took gambles in the pursuit of profit. And a lot of those gambles worked. In 2011, they were doing quite well. But the environment changed. They failed to change with it. They got caught behind. And then they desperately tried to, instead of just selling off a bad position, they tried to do a more complex hedge to kind of unwind it in a way that, you know, boggles the mind. And it just got too complicated even for them to manage.
You know, Jamie Dimon really got through the collapse of the financial markets untarnished, in part because his bank avoided some of the worst of that crisis. But this has been a very steep and quick fall. Could you give us his brief bio?
Jamie Dimon, 56 years old, handsome guy, fast-talking New Yorker. He started out as a protege of Sandy Weill, the famous guy who put together the Citigroup Travelers merger. Eventually had a falling out with Sandy Weill, two strong-willed men. He went off to Chicago as CEO of Bank One, which later merged with J.P. Morgan Chase, putting him a year later at the helm of that bank, which is now the biggest in the United States in terms of both assets and profits.
Dimon has also been very close to past and current members of the Obama administration, which suggests he was quite trusted by the White House.
Yes, as you mentioned in your intro, he came to be known as Obama's favorite banker. He's a Democrat. I think he supported Obama in 2008. Not so sure he will in 2012, judging from his recent statements. At some point along the line, it's kind of funny. He seemed like he was alienated by some of the things that were being said. He didn't like it when Obama made a comment about fat cat bankers.
He took it personally somehow.
He took it personally. He certainly did. And he bristled at that. He didn't like the Dodd-Frank Act, which he thought was hemming in banks like his that didn't need to be hemmed in. And he really hated it when the Occupy Wall Street people marched up past his Park Avenue co-op.
Right. They put it on some tour, I guess, of, you know, fat cat
exactly.
Bankers.
Yes.
You mentioned Dodd-Frank. Is there a way to give us a simple overview, if that's possible, of the Dodd-Frank bill, which Congress passed almost 2 years ago?
One of the biggest financial reforms probably since the 1930s, with many, many parts to it, protections for consumers, rules to try to keep banks from getting in trouble again and imperiling, you know, the global economy. And one of the key planks in it is this Volcker rule, named after the former Fed chairman Paul Volcker. And it was aimed at keeping the banks from risking depositors by basically taking the money that they raise and speculating with it. It allows only very narrow exceptions for bank trading. Of course, people like Jamie Dimon would like to interpret the exemptions as broadly as possible.
Right. In fact, Dimon has spoken out forcefully against this proposal.
He has said that he supports the ban on speculative trading. The problem really comes down to how he defines speculative trading. He defines it in a way that is quite favorable to the bank's ability to continue to do the kind of trades that this chief investment office did.
Is his basic argument that this law handcuffs banks on the very basic of what they want to do, what their businesses are built on?
He likes to compare J.P. Morgan to a Walmart or a Costco. In fact, he's used those exact companies as comparisons, saying if a Walmart or a Costco sells a polka dot dress and then nobody wants to buy it, the company takes the loss, and why should anybody else worry about that? And that they need to do transactions that will benefit their customers. He presents it as an argument that the freedom that they want is all about helping their customers. Of course, the critics say, no, it's not. It's all about enriching shareholders and creating bigger bonuses for the CEO and the top traders.
Right, and critics say it, sometimes the taxpayers end up holding the bag because if the FDIC has insured money that's behind those losses, taxpayers suffer. So what does Diamond say about that?
Well, he says that in this case, for example, there's no danger at all to the FDIC because this is well within the bounds of losses that the bank can easily sustain. And he says even in the 2008 financial crisis, the J.P. Morgan was forced to accept capital by the government, didn't really need it. And he says that they're well capitalized, which is another way of saying they're financially strong, and that should be the bulwark. And as long as that bulwark is in place, things like the Dodd-Frank Act, the Volcker Rule are extraneous and even counterproductive.
But isn't there a concern that even within J.P. Morgan there could be more trades we don't know about that are larger and maybe could someday affect taxpayers?
Either at J.P. Morgan or some other bank. Remember, the reason that J.P. Morgan was such a strong voice is that it had done well. But the point is not that J.P. Morgan or Jamie Dimon was a bad executive. The point is that he was a good executive, and this still happened. So that's what tells you that there's maybe still more needs to be done to tighten up regulation to make the financial system more secure.
Right, this idea that even if the best of the best can get caught off guard and have these kind of losses, what about far from the best of the best?
Exactly, and that's what's made this fairly routine $2 billion trading loss into almost a morality tale for 2012.
Going back to Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, we've heard this phrase, Dimonfreude, play on words, of course, of schadenfreude, finding joy in the misfortune of others circulating. But yet we also hear that really there shouldn't be schadenfreude at all, because when Jamie Dimon is hurt, when his reputation is harmed, it affects the entire banking industry and increases the likelihood that it will be more regulated to its dismay.
Well, you have the community bankers, the small banks, were angry all the time that the big banks have gotten away with murder, that they're able to borrow more cheaply because they're seen as too big to fail. You have the hedge funds who traded against J.P. Morgan for years. And, of course, we have all the lawmakers who've been demonized by Jamie Dimon over the years. So there is some schadenfreude here, probably understandably on the part of some. But as you say, it's not a good thing when a major bank discovers that its risk controls were not as good as they thought they were.
Peter, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the White House is stepping up talks with the Treasury Department to make sure the Volcker Rule doesn't get watered down. You mentioned the Volcker Rule briefly before the break. It's supposed to prevent banks from putting their depositors' money at risk. But could you give us a little more history on that?
Well, of course, Paul Volcker was the very highly respected chairman of the Federal Reserve, conquered inflation in the early 1980s by putting the economy through the ringer. And he he's a Democrat, but he still has a lot of respect from people across the financial sector. He's the one who said he doesn't think banks should be using money from depositors to speculate, that a bank should be a bank. A commercial bank should take deposits and make loans, and that's pretty much it. If you want to do investment banking, if you want to do speculative trading, oddball investments, be a hedge fund. And, you know, those are the people who make the big bucks by taking the big risks, but taxpayers and depositors should not be exposed to that kind of risk. And it's a fairly simple concept. It's the implementation that's incredibly difficult, and that's where we are right now, fighting over that.
The Volcker Rule is supposed to ban banks from trading with their own money. If it's not their own money, whose money is it?
Banks are still allowed to carry out trades on behalf of their customers when it's the customer's money at stake. There are even exceptions when they can do trading. It's called market making. For example, if your customer needs to buy, then you'll sell. And if the customer needs to sell, you'll buy. That's considered fairly routine. But it can easily lead to trouble because it's sometimes hard to draw the line between what's market making and what's speculation. Ditto with hedging. Hedging is when you create a risk reduction by offsetting one position with another opposite position. And that also can be easily abused by people who want to use it to speculate.
Is there a bookie metaphor here where you try to find one person to bet on one way and one person to bet the opposite to balance everything out?
Oh, we're comparing bankers to bookies, are we? I think that's fair to say, yes. That's the basic idea.
And Volcker is not yet in place, the Volcker rule, but it's still in play. It's being drafted, written, and considered.
Exactly. They went to work right away after the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010 to try to create rules to implement the Volcker rule. They finally came out with a draft proposal last October, and of course immediately everyone started taking pot shots at it. The comments run to thousands and thousands of pages. Regulators are reading through those comments now and trying to come up with a final rule in time for the two-year anniversary of Dodd-Frank, because the Volcker rule is supposed to take effect this July.
Many regulators are saying that even if it were fully written and implemented, they're not sure it would have stopped the kind of trades that are now losing billions for J.P. Morgan.
Well, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, one of the chief regulators of the banking system, has said that it cannot conclude, based on what it knows now, whether or not the transactions that J.P. Morgan conducted would have passed muster with the Volcker rule or not.
And all of this has reignited the debate over the Glass-Steagall Act, created in the 1930s, repealed in the 90s. It was set up to prevent banks from putting depositors' money at risk. Tell us a little more about that.
After some of the abuses that contributed to the Great Depression, the Glass-Steagall Act was passed in 1933 to separate commercial and investment banking. It seen a way of reducing fraud and risk, and it stayed on the books until 1999 when it was repealed. Actually, oddly enough, in the aftermath of the deal by Sandy Weill and Jamie Dimon that created Citigroup from Citicorp and Travelers. So Jamie Dimon actually played a role probably in the dissolution of the Glass-Steagall Act. That is a structural separation, and it's another approach. It's a little different from the Volcker rule approach. It just says, not only do you ban commercial banks doing certain kind of activities, you don't even allow them to be in the same company as an investment bank. You just structurally separate them.
Is there a belief or a growing belief that repeal was a mistake?
Well, you can certainly find a lot of people who would like to reenact Glass-Steagall. I don't think it's the majority point of view yet, anyway. The usual comeback is, hey, look, the way banks got into a lot of their trouble was by making dumb loans, right? Dumb mortgage loans. We all are familiar with those. That could have existed even with Glass-Steagall.
So 4 years after the near meltdown of Wall Street, are we any safer than we were back then?
We are safer. The Dodd-Frank Act did put in some valuable changes that they're already helping us. I spoke to Barney Frank about this, actually, and he feels that the stronger capital rules, that is creating a bigger cushion of safety for banks, is important. There's a new provision that's intended to force even the biggest banks to be taken apart if they get in trouble, so that they can't just claim to be too big to fail. And of course, there are new consumer protections, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and so on. So yeah, there have been improvements. Whether they're enough is another question, but there has been some movement in the right direction.
Peter Coy, I'm interested in your view as a financial journalist. Overall, has this J.P. Morgan situation been a good thing for the banking world because it exposes more problems that need to be fixed, or is there not much silver lining in this?
I think that if the losses were occurring, it's good that we know about them, because sunshine is the best disinfectant. It's better to have this come out now. It's almost like an inoculation, to switch metaphors. A small problem like this, well manageable, can possibly strengthen the immune system so that we won't have bigger problems in the future. So I'd say on net, so I'm glad we know about this. I'm not glad it happened, but I'm glad that if it did happen, we know about it.
So that's the optimist view.
Right.
Peter Coy is the economics editor for Bloomberg Businessweek. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
It's prom season, and along with the elaborate hairdos and slinky dresses, there's another teenage ritual, drinking. Schools around the country have tried to stop prom-related drinking by starting proms in late afternoon, providing mandatory transportation from school, even making kids walk a straight line to waiting buses. But schools have little control over what happens at private after-prom parties, so some communities are telling parents to beware. 28 states have some variation of so-called social host liability laws, which make it illegal for parents to provide alcohol to minors. These laws hit the headlines in Massachusetts last week when a mother in the Boston area was sentenced to 6 months in jail for supplying alcohol to her daughter's friend, even though no fatalities were involved. And some high schools are now offering social host liability training, One of them is Belmont High School in Belmont, Massachusetts. Its principal is Dr. Michael Harvey, who joins us by phone. Dr. Harvey, why do you think holding these training sessions is important for your community?
I think it's definitely an issue that parents need to be made aware of. We have conducted some surveys in the past that have shown us that it is something that's going on in our community.
Who or what group ran this seminar for you?
For us, it was the Middlesex District Attorney's Office. They have a group called the Middlesex Partnerships for Youth, and they run a whole series of trainings on legal issues for parents.
You know, some of our listeners might be startled to hear that parents are supplying their own children and their children's friends with alcohol. What is it you hear from parents about why they do that?
You know, I think on some level, parents feel conflicted over the issue. I think they're concerned that their children are engaging in these behaviors anyway, and they think it, on some level it might be better or safer if they're doing it under their own roof.
And tell us why you feel that it is not safe for that to be the case.
Well, I think there are a lot of, you know, anecdotal stories that we hear where, you know, students leave the party and, you know, things go horribly wrong afterwards. You know, I think even with some of those best intentions, it's just a dangerous practice to have, you know, teenagers and mixing with alcohol.
You mentioned that you hear anecdotal stories, but we understand that you also get weekly reports from the local police department that often document parent-supervised house parties where things have gone wrong.
That's true. Yeah, we do.
How well attended are these seminars, and do you think you're reaching enough of the community with them?
I think we had over 30 parents at the seminar this past week. I wish we could get every parent in the school to be a part of this. I think everybody needs to hear it.
Principal Harvey, you also have your assistant principal with you, Carol Cohen. And I understand she can jump on the line and give us a sense of what exactly happens at these training sessions on social host liability. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Well, there were four different presenters. An assistant district attorney was there who talked about the law, what the laws are, and the implications that once a person is arraigned, that they then have a criminal record. Christopher Peterson from the Campbell Trial Lawyers Group gave a PowerPoint presentation that he entitled Parents Not Pals and gave horrendous examples of things that went horribly wrong, even when parents thought they were working in their children's best interest. So I hosted the party because I wanted my kids to be safe here, and yet terrible, horrendous things happened. And then Lieutenant Santangelo and Chief McLaughlin talked about incidents in Belmont and what they are trying to do to help children remain safe and their enactment of the social host law.
Were there any parents in attendance who said, I have given alcohol to my kids at parties?
Nobody. Nobody admitted to it.
Admitted to it.
But there was a question of how do I teach my child to drink responsibly, to which the answer is, until they're 21, they should not be drinking. Once you start to drink, your judgment's impaired and things can go incredibly wrong.
So I guess that's the tough reality of parenting, is you have to say you are not allowed.
Correct.
Dr. Harvey, these seminars you're offering are primarily for parents, as I understand it. But
right.
Do you also do anything to let kids know that it's not okay to drink in their friends' homes, even if the parents are there?
It's a tricky piece for us because it's not a school function. Those police reports I get from Saturday, I really have very little recourse to do anything but read them. But we're sending the message to students that they need to wait as best we can.
Dr. Michael Harvey is the principal of Belmont High School in Belmont, Massachusetts. Dr. Harvey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
And Carol Cohen is assistant principal. Carol Cohen, thanks very much.
No problem.
Division I universities spend an incredible amount of money on their sports programs, but only a handful make enough from sports to stay in the black. According to a report in USA Today this week, 10 schools where football is the big sport made or spent at least $100 million on athletics last year. The University of Texas tops the list when it comes to profits. It earned about $17 million from sports and kicked $6 million of that back to the academic side of the school. But other schools are struggling to compete, both on the field and on the balance sheet. Included in that group is Florida State, a member of the Atlantic Coast Conference. The former football power has fallen on hard times. It's losing games and fan support, and that means losing money. Brad Wolverton has crunched these numbers for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he joins us from his desk at the Chronicle. Brad, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hi, Sasha.
Brad, tell us more about what's going on at Florida State in terms of how big the budget problem for the football program is and how the university is trying to deal with it.
The university's athletic department has a $2.4 million budget hole, which may not seem like a lot on a budget of nearly $60 million. But if you look at their spending down there, the problem is, like a lot of schools, Florida State's athletic budget has gone way up in recent years, 20% just in the past couple of seasons. And they've got plans to kind of take on several new capital projects, which is going to add another $45 million potentially. The real problem is that the donations are off too, so that this is a school that relies heavily on seat license fees. So when the football team does well, people are willing to pay for their seats. Well, that hasn't happened in recent years, and so those donations haven't come in. And so what you see is football is really the main source of revenue for a school like this.
Brad, you said the budget is up 20%. Why has it jumped like that?
Well, scholarship costs have gone up, but there's also spending on salaries. I think coaches' salaries are really what drives a lot of the spending in college sports these days. There's also, you know, it's not as cheap to travel, and so there's a, you know, the ACC goes all the way up to, you know, Boston, and so it's a long plane ride and a lot of travel for a lot of teams, not just football programs. So, but I think the real spending problem and the real spending crunch has come in the salary increases for football and basketball coaches.
And would you give us a rundown of which other schools are having similar problems?
Even in the ACC alone, Maryland has a pretty significant budget hole of almost $5 million. Their response to it was even more drastic than Florida State's, which has been they have to cut eight sports, which is pretty shocking for a school that is kind of in the big time. So to have two programs like Florida State and Maryland that have had to cut back significantly. We saw a lot of schools cutting travel and salaries across the board and pruning through the recession, but that's all ended. I mean, I think everybody's looking right now for ways to negotiate bigger TV and marketing deals and just bolster their bottom lines with new revenue sources. And so I think it's a really unusual time in college sports where you're seeing a continued spending, but you're not seeing maybe in some cases as much money coming in.
So these budget problems are a mixture of revenues going down and expenses going up. But does it get exacerbated when there's poor performance on the field and suddenly there's less attendance, so less ticket money coming in?
Exactly. I mean, the contributions that come into programs, which some people call donations, they are partly charitable. They rely heavily on whether the teams are winning and whether people are willing to pay for those seat license fees, which give them a chance to buy the tickets. So there's two sources, main sources of revenue. And just a few years ago, booster support became the number one source of revenue for colleges' athletic departments. And so, I mean, everybody talks about TV money and how it's growing so fast, but the bottom line is dependable fan support is a really big deal in college sports, and they need those teams to win.
And just to clarify, when you talk about booster support, are you just talking about people willing to buy tickets, or are these people willing to make donations on top of buying tickets?
Well, generally the way it happens is you have to make a donation in order to buy the tickets. And it can be, you know, anywhere from a couple thousand dollars to way more than that into the, you know, tens or fifteen thousands of dollars just to guarantee a chance to buy the seat in the best location. And so that's the real source of revenue that has increased for a lot of these big time programs. And when the schools don't win on the field, in the case of Maryland, their football team hasn't won in a long time, their booster support has fallen off 40% in the past few years.
Brad, you also wrote in the Chronicle of Higher Ed that the way two of these schools, FSU and Maryland, communicated the problems they were having caused them even more trouble. Would you explain that?
Well, I think at Maryland what happened was they were sitting on some significant budget issues for many years, and there was a turnover at the top with the athletic director, and I think the new athletic director came in and realized that they had some significant problems, but they unfortunately didn't communicate those problems to its own board of trustees until they got to the point where they had to cut eight sports. And a lot of those trustees weren't happy about it. A lot of the people who are on those teams obviously aren't happy about it. It's not nearly as bad as the way Maryland handled it, but Florida State did kind of a similar thing recently when it sort of brought up, hey, all of a sudden we've got a $2.5 million budget hole, and we're going to have to cut expenses 10% across the board for travel and recruiting expenses. And if you want to win in football, you need to spend money on recruiting. And so that hasn't really sat well with the fan base.
Is it fair to say that, at least for now, the most college presidents have decided that the benefits of these teams are worth the expense?
Oh, definitely. I mean, and if you look at the overall cost of an athletic department in terms of how it, you know, compares to the budget of a university, it's really still it's under 5% of an overall budget, but they're growing so fast. I mean, some schools like LSU's budget has grown 83% in a recent time span, and I think if you look at over time, those budgets could become a much larger part of a university's overall budget, 10 to 15% of the overall budget, which is really concerning for some people because the salaries are really where the main growth is, and I don't see that slowing. So that's really a problem that they've got to fix.
Well, Rutgers, as one example, says that its sports spending represents less than 1% of the university's overall budget. And it says that its sports programs provide positive exposure for the school. But at what point does a sports program get too big to sustain? Is that part of the issue here?
Well, Rutgers, you know, there was a recent report that Rutgers students are really fronting the majority of the cost of their athletic program. I mean, they pay each student who goes to Rutgers, more than 30,000 students, pays over $1,000 each per year in student fees to finance sports, right, basically to float the football program.
Whether or not they're athletes themselves.
Exactly, whether or not they're playing on scholarship or playing intercollegiate athletics. And so if you go to school at Rutgers, you're going to pay $1,000 a year in student fees to just have an athletic department, whether or not you like sports or not, or even go to the game. So there are increasing questions that students across the country are asking, and you know they're kind of raising objections to spending that money at a time when they don't have a lot of money and their families are really scrimping.
But sports really has been sacrosanct in the college forum for so long.
Sports isn't going anywhere. I've news for you. It's certainly you know it's big money, but it's also with the TV money that's come in. I mean a lot more of these programs are more self-sufficient now, so I don't think that it's going away.
Brad Wolverton is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Brad, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
In my dreams, I see a fat man on his face. There's a frown.
Well, there's no frown on the face of our next guest. That's because John Fulbright has been gathering critical acclaim in his hometown of Okemah, Oklahoma, and beyond. The praise is for his debut CD, From the Ground Up.
I only pray at night when the world disappears. Put away and out of sight, I confront my fears.
John Fulbright is just 24 years old, but critics are already comparing him to the likes of Randy Newman, Townes Van Zandt, and Leon Russell for his unique blend of folk, blues, gospel, and Americana rock.
Are you gonna stop? I said, no, sir, no, sir. I got a little bit of time to go. Where you gonna go? I said, up, sir, up, sir, up to the middle of a mountain road.
One musician who's been on our show a lot, Jimmy Webb, says of his fellow Oklahoman, I have no doubt that in a very short time, John Fulbright will be a household name in American music. That's all it took for us to invite John Fulbright to our studios while his tour brought him to Boston. John, welcome.
Thank you.
John, let's start at the beginning to the first track on the CD, which is titled God Above. That's G-A-W-D, God. You sing as if you were the supreme being, and you've referred to the song as showing sympathy for the Creator.
Yeah, it's kind of God with a gold tooth, kind of hanging out at the French Quarter, flipping a coin up and down.
So a little sacrilegious in a way.
Yeah.
6 long days, 7th day he rested, said there's one sure way humans can be bested, give them wine and song, fire and lust, when it all goes wrong, I'm the man to trust, and now you're all my own, all mine together, will you sing my praise, sing my name forever, I am God above, Lord.
On the CD, after God Above, there are songs called Jericho, I Only Pray at Night, and Satan and St. Paul. It makes it sound like you're a religious person.
Right.
Would you say that?
No. It's more of biblical text and that kind of stuff as being just really great metaphor. If you really had something you felt strongly about, it's a really great way of expressing that. The song Moving on there at the end, it's kind of this evangelical thing where it's like, I'll meet you in a better place.
Well, the world will keep turning when I'm dead and gone, but I'll see you again and it won't be too long. Maybe we'll meet in a place where there ain't no pain.
We've mentioned that you're from Okemah, Oklahoma. Many of our listeners may know that as the birthplace of Woody Guthrie. And you have said that you like his books, but that it is somewhat hard for you to listen to his music. Why is that?
I like his writing. I don't like his voice.
His voice?
Yeah. And I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. But, Woody, he's my right-hand man, you know. But as far as musically, I would much rather listen to Tom Waits.
So you may not like to listen to Woody sing, but let's listen to you sing. You have your guitar with you. Could you play your song, Forgotten Flowers?
Yeah, sure. All right. I'm still figuring this out while I'm doing it. I've got diamonds in my backyard. Well, they grow just like weeds. You'll come and gather them in bundles. Take all that you need, but save the flowers there for me, dear. Take the diamonds for your grief, 'cause the flowers don't grow like weeds. Glory, glory, hallelujah, I'm lost. And she's found another lover to give her shelter when the fields have turned brown. Another kind man to warm her when the snow finds the ground. The only girl, may the world go round. Well, there's some things worth remembering, others left for time to come and weather and to change in the winds of your mind. But don't forget me while you're leaving. Just remember my rhyme, 'cause it's all that I borrowed from time. Now it's Sunday, early evening. I rise for the day, brush a long hair from the pillow on my bed. She would lay, and in the backyard, forgotten flowers are all fading away to bloom in other lovers' backyards someday. To bloom in other lovers' backyards someday.
Jean, there's a line in there where you're waking up alone one morning and you say, you brush a long hair from the pillow on my bed where she would lay. Is that for real? Has your heart sort of been perhaps broken in that sense, or have you lost somebody, or are you just really good at identifying with people who have?
The funny thing to me about that line is it's like, how long has she been gone that you haven't changed that pillowcase? You know?
Hairs stick around sometimes even through washes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but, you know, it's a question that I find myself asking when I'm singing it. Have I gone through heartbreak and heartache? Yeah, sure. But specifically, I'll leave that up to you. There's a fire
burning deep inside and it's mad. John Fulbright's debut studio CD is From the Ground Up. For our listeners in the New York area, you can catch John tonight at The Living Room. To see where else he's touring and to watch videos of some of the songs you just heard, go to hereandnow.org. John, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Please join us again tomorrow for more Here and Now.